You're listening to the Bold True Life podcast with Hana and Maymuna. We're sisters, life coaches, and we have honest conversations about what it takes to blaze your own trail in life.
This means we'll be talking about the triumphs and the struggles of showing up to our lives with authenticity, courage, and mindfulness. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Hey guys, this is Hanat popping in real quick to introduce our guest for this episode. My sister and I had the pleasure of interviewing our cousin Timaj Garad. She's a storyteller, creative consultant, arts educator, and community organizer based in Toronto. And we had a really interesting conversation that centered around vulnerability and cultivating supportive communities. We're so excited to share this episode with you all because the work that Timaj is doing resonates so much with both of us. She's incredibly talented and, as you'll see soon, has a way with words. So without further ado, let's jump right in.
Freda looks exactly like me. Freda looks exactly like me. And I know that it's right beneath my feet. And I can see it every step I walk, because freedom looks exactly like me. And I know that it's right inside me. And I can see that it's right inside you, and we need to. I rode the train 6 times today from one terminal station to another. You don't know, you're one of the many people I've watched fill and empty this train in succession, and out of all of them, you're the only one I knew would ask me this question you asked: how are you? Sometimes when people ask me how I am, I want to say, I feel as though my heart may implode, or that the blood inside it may boil over my rib cage, leaving it looking like tomato soup stained stove elements, or that I may at any instant shatter into a billion pieces and litter the floor beneath your feet with myself. I want to say, my mouth feels pregnant with the earth. My teeth are white picket fences of polite speech holding in shifting continents of a world spinning madly out of orbit. I want to ask you, do you know how it feels to be pregnant in the mouth with more than you even know how to say, and fear you may abort the whole world and everything in it with silence? You don't answer. Instead, you watch my mouth bloat with everything I've ever known, and I know it seems strange, but sometimes I can feel my blood changing colors like a mood ring, and some colors it becomes makes me want to wring it out of my veins like water out of washed clothes, because I can't always bear to wear myself when I feel this heavy. I said I can't always bear to wear myself when I feel this heavy. And I imagine you understanding, as if we're speaking the same language. And you would say something like, you would say, the emptying and refilling of ourselves often leaves us fuller than before. But instead, I have to translate every feeling. I tell you, I will start a revolution and protest the drought I caused in me until I bleed myself profusely and passionately back into myself, until freedom becomes my skin wrapped tightly around the whole thing, because freedom looks exactly like me. Because freedom looks exactly like. But I look up to meet your lost eyes, that blank face stare, and you're nodding your head so consistently that I wonder if perhaps you've started to drift off into a hip hop beat to drown me out. You move in closer, but still seem to be moving towards the other end of this train. So again, I tried to reach you, because before the revolution, I wanted to tell you to hold me more, because I felt I may tatter, collapse, and expose these shattered fragments, masquerading as a complete person, if not held together. But the look in your eyes tells me you don't know how to make glue out of your arms anyway. I wish I knew then that it's not something you needed to know how to do, but if only the question, What revolution are you talking about? Wasn't hanging from your iris like a lost eyelash in unfamiliar fields of view? If only you could feel this view from where I am, then we could say this all casually, like we're talking about the weather. It wouldn't spook you, it would move you, because you of all people would know that it's okay to let small talk fall like a deep sigh back into its common cocoon, so that it can take the time it needs in seclusion to grow wildly honest enough to take flight and journey between our mouths, seeing the world. But instead of seeing the world, I am just on a train. And we've been stuck on this train forever, feasting on little cities, citizens lost and sitting on my tongue like an aftertaste. This is just the story of the lie I told you that day, and I'm sorry I couldn't say more. I just didn't feel safe. These words are like ghosts wandering the graveyards of things I should have said, because when you asked me how I was, I assassinated truth, turned autopilot onto autocommute to an acceptable answer, dug graves for the words that didn't make the cut between my lips. I swallowed the entire globe in one sentence and said, good, how are you?
Wow. Before you get into your conversation about this, I am just so curious about our little takeaways. Mm-hmm. Hannah, what was your big thing that you took away from that?
That was so interesting, because what kept happening to me was like I would be struck by a line and then you would say something else and then I would be like, oh shoot, I forgot the other line because I'm like so struck by the next line. And I'm thinking like, I wish I was like writing things down as you were talking, but that would have taken away from, you know, listening to you too. But I feel like there were just so many, what's the right word, like drop the mic moments, I guess, but then you just kept on going. I have to say, because this kept happening to me, the ending was probably the part that I'm going to remember the most. And I loved how you were just like, good, how are you after all that? And that's exactly what happens to us, right? We have a million and one thoughts running through our mind, but all we can say is like five words at the end of it all.
Right.
My big takeaway was, first of all, I didn't expect the beginning, which was so beautiful. And then, yeah, same here. I was like, ooh, that was good. Ooh. And I was trying to keep up. My brain was trying to keep up. But I think it's such a perfect intro into our conversation, because these are really hard conversations to have about uncertainty. For us to get up here, it takes quite a bit of vulnerability. For you, the performance is vulnerable, I'm sure, because it's your work, it's Imaj. And it takes quite a bit of vulnerability to get up here and talk about things we feel uncertain around. Yeah, that's what we do. We go, yeah, I'm great. How are you? So tell us about your piece. What was it about when you were writing it? And help us understand.
Yeah, so the piece, it was about just that, just vulnerability and how difficult it is, but also that we don't always feel safe to be vulnerable or to be, and especially some of us who are, you know, kind of walking around with targets on our back, who are racialized, who already are dealing with a lot of assumptions about us, stereotypes, etc. And just that feeling of, you know, wanting to be vulnerable, wanting to have connection, but feeling held back by those things, right? So feeling like you're carrying so many silences in you and you're experiencing erasure of your identity, of your experience, of your humanity, as you are wanting to be more open. So it's that kind of duality of, well, I want to be more present and connected and, you know, vulnerable, but then I'm also held back by these very real barriers to that. And as much as we say vulnerability is a strength, and it is, there's also that reality of, you know, vulnerability can leave us open and exposed in a lot of ways too. So where is the balance, right? When I was writing that, is really an expression of those like kind of anxieties and feeling that there has to be a way that we can connect authentically and know each other, and that's kind of also the answer to do away with all the kind of isms and things that hold us back from being fully comfortable and safe being ourselves. Is like the only real way to do away with discrimination and that kind of thing is to know each other and to learn how to love each other through knowing each other. It's the fear of the other that has people feeling like they can't actually engage, right? And that they can't connect. And that disproportionately hurts racialized folks more than others, obviously. So it's not necessarily a political piece. The way that I think of it is the personal, for me, is also a political space. How we walk through this world, the things that we hold on to, the ways in which that affects our mental state and our mental health. This is primarily a piece about mental health and about, you know, what happens when you hold things inside, what happens when you don't have that permission to be vulnerable. And not only because you're not giving it to yourself, but because the landscape does not allow for that in some ways. There's this kind of censorship or this feeling of not being able to be open in certain ways. And then that expectation, that social expectation of like, don't say too much, don't share too much about yourself, don't be vulnerable. And, you know, if you answer that question, how are you, with anything other than I'm good, how are you? People find that odd. People find that strange. Like, you, there's no really space for that in a lot of conversations or situations. So really just having those moments of honesty with ourselves. For me, it was just me working through that feeling within myself and trying to kind of understand, like, okay, well, I'm feeling like I have more to say, like I have more to share, that I'm feeling disconnected. And what is that, right? So that's kind of what came out.
So how do you answer that question now? How are you? Do you still say good? How are you?
Typically. So when I wrote that piece, I felt like I needed to be vulnerable with everybody. Like, I needed to find a way to have everyone be my safe person. And that's not, and I guess that's the introvert in me, but that's not how I feel anymore. So I think selective vulnerability is important, but then also creating community is also important. So for right now, I would say with the people that I know and love and love me, I'm definitely more vulnerable. And also I'm able to be more vulnerable in community spaces, whether it's the ones I've built or that I've joined that also have that safety within them. And so the answer to my own piece is just building safe spaces for ourselves, or at least safe as possible spaces for ourselves, really focusing on what it means to be in community with people, to actually create communities that are compassionate and supportive. I think a lot of the time when we think of communities, we just think of a gathering of people who meet regularly, and that's not what community is. Community is being able to actually support each other in real, tangible ways. And I think that even like in terms of, you know, my spiritual understanding of that, like the Islamic perspective, is community is not just a group of people that see each other often. It's not even necessarily a family. Community is people that you can feel that safety with and that you know they have you, like they got you if anything were to happen, right? So having that sense of community and being loved and also giving love, I think that that's made the difference. And, you know, alhamdulillah, I feel like I have built that in my life in various ways. It's still a work in progress, but a lot of my work has really just been about how do we create the safety in our lives, in our sacred spaces? How do we create sanctuaries for ourselves where we can have those conversations, right? And where we can, where we don't have to be silent, because we don't have to necessarily unsilence ourselves everywhere. We don't have to necessarily talk to everyone about everything that's going on. That's not even smart, but we do have to feel that there's somewhere we can go and that there is someone that will listen, right? And there's just somewhere that can be that safe haven for us. So for me, that the answer is building those relationships within my own life and also on a community level. And I do a lot of community work and building community, so I think that that's helped a lot. So that's a long answer, but... Yes.
It was a good one. And I think Muni and I can both definitely relate. A lot of the work that we do with Bold True Life and a little bit behind the scenes, the healing circles that we organize monthly are for exactly that reason, creating these community spaces where
we can practice being vulnerable, and it's a safe space and a safe haven for people to come to. And, you know, they're always small groups, but you're absolutely right. We need that. And your answer in the beginning struck me when you said, you know, the people that you are able to be vulnerable with right now are the ones that you love and know love you too. And I was thinking, in some cases, like when you're building communities and safe spaces, that's one thing. But then the people that are in your life that you love from day one, like our, you know, our parents, our siblings, our extended family, we love them, but sometimes those are the hardest people to be vulnerable with, because there's just so much information, I guess, over the years that we've, and baggage and, you know, everything that we've kind of collected about each other. So what is that experience like for you when you're not doing the community work and building safe spaces? How are you practicing vulnerability with your family and opening up that communication and dialogue?
I'm super vulnerable with my family, but I always have been. I'm like, even as a kid, I don't know if you all remember this about me, but I've always been the kind of person that's just like, I just said what was on my mind with my family. And my family, like my immediate family, has been able to kind of create those spaces of vulnerability. And so I've never really been someone that hides things from them. Especially with my sister, her and I are super, super vulnerable with each other. But even with every other member of my family, my parents, my brother, like I've never really felt personally, I know other people struggle with this, but personally, I've never felt that I couldn't be vulnerable. It's just that sometimes when I am, there is that, you know, those disagreements that we have. They're, you know, they have a different idea of what shame means and what it means to shame someone and that kind of thing. So like we've had to work through a lot of that. And I think that for me, I've always really been interested in seeing what that work could look like. I'm more so interested in, because I love these people, if there is something that I feel we need to learn together, I would rather be my full self and be vulnerable with them and do that work with them because I have the energy for it. We don't have the energy to do that work with everybody, but I personally have the energy to do that work with my family and work through some of those pieces that, you know, where I might be feeling shamed or they might be feeling shamed for something that one of us said, right? And so we actively do that work, and sometimes it looks like arguments, but for me, I see it as dialogue, and I see it as, you know, progress when we're having conversations like that, because I know a lot of people don't feel safe to do that in their families. And a lot of people's families don't even want to hold space for the conversation itself. Right. So for me, if I feel like, you know, my parents or whatever have said something that shames me or whatever it is, like I can just say, hey, this is how I feel about what you said. And to some extent, I feel like, yes, if you feel unsafe in your family to the point where it might cause like real psychic or physical harm to tell those truths, then I would say that's when we have to make decisions about what makes sense in terms of vulnerability. Maybe it doesn't make sense for someone in that situation to be vulnerable. Maybe it's not safe for that person. But I know that with my family, we do have that common goal of understanding each other. And that a lot of the times when people make decisions not to be vulnerable with their family, it's out of fear of how they will be perceived by their family, without actually giving them the benefit of the doubt that maybe it'll be okay. Maybe we can have conversations about this, right? So it's really, I think oftentimes it's fear about how you'll be perceived and fear about what it will do to, you know, the delicate balance of whatever relationship you have. But what use is it to have that relationship if it's not true, right? If it's not built on any kind of honesty. And I think that we give people less credit than they deserve when it comes to being able to do that work. A lot of the times, like, yes, our parents are from a different generation and that kind of thing. And it might take time. It might be frustrating. It might be hard. But a lot of the time they are able to do that work and they're open to it. If it's coming from a place of, you know, that there's love there. And I'm not talking about situations of abuse and neglect. That's a completely different thing. But if you know that it's just a difference of ideology and there's love there, there's the ability to connect, then keeping the peace is not worth it to me. It's not worth keeping the peace and living in a lie, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I think that just given our very specific context, the culture that we come from, and just communal cultures in general, keeping the peace has always been priority number one. Mm-hmm. And I think for us in the West, just more individualistic cultures, and it could even be in the East now, you know, could even be just like the times, your truth is at least just as important. So, right. And so just trying to find that bit, but like when you're in smaller communities, it's such a difficult terrain to kind of figure out and navigate, because the minute you open your mouth and you do tell your truth, and that truth is maybe not generally acceptable, communally acceptable, especially if it's like, if it's a bigger deal, it really like A, word travels fast. And then B, like you said, you just have to be very selective with who you're sharing what with, because there can be real damage, and right. people need to process their truth. They can't even begin to process it without talking about it. And then you're talking about it to people who may be reactive to you, and that's not really considered a safe space then. Yeah. So it's always like a bit of a tug of war, I think, with that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I feel privileged to have a family that I can be vulnerable with in a way I don't feel that it would do any real damage. Like, I might feel frustrated or upset or experience those negative emotions, but at the end of the day, we can still have a conversation about it, you know? So that is a privilege that not everybody has. And especially in larger communities, like the more people consist of a community, the harder it is, because then not everyone is going to be on the same page, right? So I think that ethics, building ethics in a community, is more important than coming to the same conclusion or having the same ideology. Because at least the ethics of, okay, if someone says something, you keep it confidential if you know that it's private. Or if someone says something, you don't gossip about them to other members in the community, right? So it's more having the ethics in a community. I think that's more important to feeling safe than actually having everyone on the same page. Because someone can disagree with you, even disagree with you about something very important to you, but their ethical and their moral compass doesn't allow them to gossip about it, doesn't allow them to shame you about it, doesn't allow them to feel justified in ostracizing you about it, right? Mm. So those are the differences for me. And that's how I see community. And I think that, you know, people that are community organizers, activists, etc., we've kind of lost our way a little bit in what community means, because there is this kind of, and this is the Canadian context, different kind of activist organizing spaces here. You can let me know if it's like this in the States. There's this kind of cancel culture that exists, you know, where it's, you're not feeling the same way about something. If someone in the community has a separate ideology from you, then that person is just not welcome anymore, or that person needs to be called out, or whatever it is. And that is something that really, really is destructive to the health of a community, because that means that you are disposable in that community, right? And knowing that you're disposable, even if you share the common ideology or the dominant narrative or whatever it is, knowing that you're disposable prevents you from being vulnerable and prevents you from feeling safe, right? Mm. So that's something that people really need to work on. And I see it in Muslim communities too, right? Like, oh, like, you're not following this madhab, or you're Shia, you're Sunni. Like, it's just, you know, it's like, it's a mess. And I think that the ethical understanding of how we're going to deal with a difference of opinion in a community or a different story or whatever it is, that's more important than what people actually believe.
I'm curious about what you define as ethics, because a lot of times what ends up happening, you're just like, you hit the nail on the head. What people define as ethics is your ideology the same as mine? Mm-hmm. Do you agree with me especially like if you're talking now religious communities and or even like activist culture, when you're dealing with it's really simple things like what is racism, like feminism, whatever it is. And the minute people perceive you crossing the line of what they consider ethical,
right,
then they step into this place of, you know, cancel culture. So what do you consider the types of behaviors that are the glue for communities in this way?
So when I say ethics of behavior, ethics of community, I mostly mean their behavioral ethics, like it's not necessarily their values. Mm. It's their code of conduct. Mm. So how do you respond to different values? Right. Mm. So if someone, you know, for example, has a different opinion on race or racism, yeah, you can be vehemently against their opinion. They could even be like factually kind of wrong about what they think or what they believe. But instead of reducing that person to that one ideology, an ethical community or a community that operates on an ethical code of conduct would try to first actively listen to that person's opinion. If they're saying something hateful or harmful, then you create boundaries and parameters and you make that clear, right? Instead of responding in anger, instead of responding by, you know, disposing of them immediately, there needs to be some sort of like a process for calling someone in, for having those conversations, you know, it doesn't mean you're in a, like a boundaryless society. It just means that the way that you establish your boundaries still respects that person's humanity. And I think that even just Islamically, it's that understanding that anyone can change, anyone can, and if it's something that actually needs to be changed, right? Anyone can change, and that we are supposed to be like really merciful with the way that we deal with people, right? We're supposed to give people that room to develop and change and understand things that maybe that is not something they have access to at the moment. And then a lot of the times, though, it's not even that their beliefs are harmful. A lot of the times it's just that their beliefs are not your beliefs, or their values are not your beliefs, right? So yeah, we could talk about the extreme case of someone who's like racist or someone who's, but that's not even a lot of what we're dealing with in community. A lot of what we're dealing with in community is, oh, this person is part of the LGBTQ community. Let's not welcome them, or let's not, like, they can't talk about that or whatever it is. It's like, okay, well, that might conflict with your religious beliefs, but that person has a right to still be a part of community. If your community is a community that recognizes someone's humanity, then you shouldn't be ostracizing people for things like that. You know what I mean? Especially when we live in a world where there's so much information out there. There are so many different ideologies floating around. Like, people are trying to find their way. People are trying to understand their identities, right? Like, and I think the important thing is to give people space to do that, set up whatever boundaries you need to in that particular community, but then also practice that mercy and that compassion with people who you disagree with. Yeah, so that's kind of what I feel when it comes to building community.
It's interesting that we're talking about this side of it. I guess if we're going to be talking about the vulnerability part, and then also this piece of having ethics in our community and the way we treat each other, I think it's those moments when we get triggered that really affect us the most. I think we mistake often being vulnerable with saying something when we're triggered, and in that moment, it might not come off the same way as if, like Moni was saying earlier, we've had a little bit of time to process it, and then we can come back to the conversation and say, hey, this situation really made me feel like XYZ when you said this, when you did this, after we've taken a little bit of time to think about it or process it in whatever way works best for us, versus when we just say what's on our mind in the moment and we're feeling heated. It comes off very differently, and I think the conversations go very differently too. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that makes complete sense, but I think when we've had time to really think our thoughts through, it makes a big difference in how we respond, whether we're practicing vulnerability or practicing how to communicate ethically with each other in community settings.
Yeah, it's exactly kind of the gist that I got from you too, Timaj. The nugget was our responses are not just reactions.
Yeah, I think that like communication is really important, and it's something that I think I see it very seldomly done well in community, unfortunately, that a lot of people react in a very inflammatory way to things that trigger them, to things that they disagree with. And some of that work is actually internal work that each person in the community needs to do with themselves, is how do I differentiate something that I'm triggered by and something that I actually need to remove myself from in terms of harm, right? So sometimes someone will say something that triggers a memory or triggers something, and it's not that you're, that person is necessarily wrong even. It's not even that that person is doing or saying something bad. They just might have triggered something in another individual. And our triggers, I know that there's this conversation around like, almost like avoiding being triggered, but I actually think our triggers are there to teach us.
Right.
They're there to teach us about the trauma that we're still holding on to.
Mm.
So instead of hating the person that triggered you, try to look at the trigger and figure out what is it that you have such a visceral reaction to, like what healing still needs to be done, right? But we have a tendency to want to escape that feeling and that trigger. So we redirect our anger or our sadness or whatever negative emotion we're feeling to that person. And they might not even know what they said, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we redirect it. And then instead of expressing it a lot of the times, it'll fester. And then you have these interpersonal relationships that haven't even had a chance to become anything because you're so... It's so difficult to engage with someone that you feel triggered by, especially if you're not able to separate the trigger from that person. Does that make sense?
I think the conversation that this is culminating to, when you are triggered and that person is inflammatory, when you are triggered and they're actually wrong, mm-hmm. you know, trying to create this space for holding many truths that conflict mm-hmm. in a room. You know, that's the trick. And I think that's what's really hard. And we're just trying to figure out for ourselves, too. This is kind of the place, me personally, that I am in, is just trying to figure out how to do that in a compassionate way while I'm also holding real boundaries. And I think that that's, for me, this is the question and the struggle. Yeah, any nuggets on that with your community work?
So I feel like... Yeah, when the person is actually wrong or saying something harmful, then that's a different conversation. I think that communities need to have processes in place. It doesn't have to be super, super formal, but there should be a known process to address that in a way that also protects other people from being exposed to harm, right? Because eventually, if you keep hearing from someone or from multiple people in a space, something that really is dehumanizing to you, that's going to, whether or not you've done the work, that's going to create a harmful environment for you. That's a sort of trauma. And there needs to be a way of addressing that so that it stops, right? So then if we're going beyond just a difference of opinion or values and that sort of thing, and that person's actually saying something hateful, there needs to be some sort of a mechanism to have that eventually stop. And it doesn't mean that that person is never invited back to community, but it means that they're not given the space to continue doing what they're doing. And I like this idea of like also having some sort of process where you call people in, where you mediate conflicts in a way that allows the person to feel like there's a space for them in community, but not if they're going to continue to be hateful, if that makes sense.
That's the trick, because the reality is that we're not all good or all bad. The reality is each one of us come with baggage that we really need to step up and improve our behavior.
Yeah.
And it's like, when I'm behaving badly, how would I want to be treated?
Mm. Right. Yeah. And the thing is, in a lot of our communities, and the reason why I'm focusing more on difference of opinions and values and things like that, or even just like bad behavior in terms of like, okay, like you don't have to yell. People are triggered by your yelling, that kind of thing. The reason I'm focusing more on that is because that's more of what I see.
Right.
That's more of the reason why people leave community or why people are not welcome in community. It's very rare that you actually have someone that's like in a community that's designed for a particular, usually communities are designed around your identities, right? So like in a Muslim space or in a black space or whatever it is, right? Like if, or an activist space, like you very rarely have people that are extremely hateful, that are saying things that are dehumanizing and things like that. Those are, it happens, but they're kind of the more rare examples than just people that have differences with each other, right? So I think that like, people that that are saying really inflammatory, hateful things obviously need to get dealt with different in a different way. But when it comes to the breakdown of communication in communities and the lack of feeling safe in communities, it really kind of happens in the nuances of you know?
Right. Maybe you say something and you're triggered by something and you could have been, you really hurt someone.
I mean,
we do that. We do that all the time. Yeah, and I really agree with the fact that it is in the nuances. This is what we see in coaching as well. Like, we don't have to change the relationship. We literally have to change the ways we communicate. It's in the small moments. So you're absolutely right about that.
You know what I always think about, though, is are we also being accountable to ourselves when it comes to understanding our trauma or working through our trauma? Because I think that inevitably, no matter how many processes or ethical codes of conduct and community and procedures you set up for a community, if everyone in that community is still hurting, inevitably hurt people and the whole system will fall apart, right? So I think that like we have to also center our healing in spaces and each individual's healing as well as our collective healing.
I agree. That's pretty on spot. Yeah.
It's a hard thing to do because people don't know where to go to do that work.
Yeah.
I think my biggest takeaway has been this is really complicated and messy, and it's a little different for each person how they're going to have to navigate these spaces of uncertainty and vulnerability and communicating when we are still healing ourselves along the way. Mm-hmm. And I think what you just said right there with the hurt people is a really good reminder to much and a good takeaway for our particular conversation with you. Like we're all still in this space of working through stuff. And if we recognize that, we can have so much more compassion for everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your poetry and your thoughts. I wish we did this sooner.
Yeah.
Cousins. We need to do more work together. I think we're kind of on the same page. You're in Canada, we're in America, and it's crazy how we're kind of living parallel values, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
A little type of work. Yeah. It's pretty incredible. So.
It is. It's very much aligned. I've always felt that about you two, though. That in that sense.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. Same.
You know, I wonder how much of it has to do with being cousins that grew up here in the West and just kind of the mix of cultures and the mishmash that we've experienced.
Yeah, I think it also has to do with our dads, though.
Yeah, probably.
That's what I was thinking, too.
That's like true.
Same family values, yeah.
Yeah, very similar family values, and they're both very woke, for lack of a better term.
I love it.
They just stay like with your dad as well as with my dad. They have this kind of like awareness and there's like this consciousness that I think that we've both or we've all kind of inherited through that upbringing of just like whether or not we agree with everything they say. There's that like that critical engagement in the world around us. And I think that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's kind of nice to see our fathers from that light. I don't think we always give them credit.
Yeah, that's true. I've been realizing that more and more about my dad. I'm like, wow, we're more similar than I thought.
That is growing up, girl.
Yeah.
You know you're an adult when. That's right? Literally what that is.
Okay,
thank you guys. So much. This was so beautiful and great. We'd love to have other bits of your poetry on random episodes anytime. You're welcome anytime to perform for us. It would be such a treat for our listeners.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me. This was a great conversation, and I appreciate what you're doing with Bold True Life. And yeah, I can't wait to hear it.
And we will have all the ways you can connect with Timaj linked in our show notes.
Guys, if you enjoy this, please share this with a friend, and we will see you next time. Take care.
You made it to the end. Thanks so much for listening.
Don't forget to subscribe, and you can find us at boldtruelife.com/podcast or your podcast player of choice, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google.
We would love to hear your thoughts on today's conversation.
If you like what you hear, please take 2 minutes of your precious time to rate and review.
It really helps us out. Thanks.